Okay. For the sake of those who label this these recordings on the website, this is making a vow of inner nonviolence. So we all have aspects of ourselves we would really like to fix or disown or even expunge completely from our being. Laziness, greed, jealousy, anger, anxiety, depression, addiction, judgmentalism, attachment to thoughts, concern about appearance, anyone else want to add to that list?
Arrogance,
Arrogance,
disability.
disability. Rachel.
Perfectionism.
Get the imagination flowing. What else? What else? Grief. Well, more things will come up. So, my own thing that I add to that list, which I will talk about more later, is my attachment to, for lack of a better description, productive thinking. Lately, in the context of the precept class, people have been talking about things, certain more things as addictions. You know, with the understanding that, you know, there can be kind of subtle addictions, right? It's not there's very physical, real life-changing addictions, and then there's some things that we speak of that maybe we should be using the term, and maybe we shouldn't. Maybe we should be just saying attachment. But there is a way that, you know, in my example of productive thinking, where you know, you might say I'm kind of attached to it, but at a certain point it becomes kind of compulsive. And I was just thinking today about how, you know, how people say we have a puppy and like acute behavior in a puppy becomes really problematic in a full-grown dog, you know, and it's like there's these things that we do when we're younger, and it's kind of like, who cares? You know, that's just the way I am. But by the time you're like in your 40s and 50s, it's just like you can't, it's like the habit groove is worn so deeply that you can't actually do anything else. You're just kind of, it just becomes a compulsion. That is like just how you respond, how you are. And it becomes, I feel sometimes like a bit of a caricature. Like all of those habits, I just become just like a collection of like weird habits. But yeah, so in that sense, it starts to feel like an addiction in that sense that we don't really have control over it anymore. It just drives us. So some aspects of ourself change easily, especially with practice. And these can be a pleasant surprise when you start to practice and be mindful and you notice, oh, I don't have to do that. I can do this differently. And those are, I mean, they tend to be, relatively speaking, kind of surface and superficial habits, if you will. Maybe modes that we've adopted fairly recently, or they don't matter all that much to us. And we can fairly easily find alternative ways to behave. But then other things, you know, once we kind of like, okay, you know, we're like, oh, this is great. Like, I can change all these habits and I can undo all this karma. And then we just like reach these things, which just they do not transform as easily. And these are much more deeply rooted in our karma. And karma being like the behavioral cause and effect, or the all the in a strict Buddhist sense, it's only my willful behavior and how it affects my future experience. But I like to think of it in a more broad way than that. All of the causes and effects that have led up to my being and my experience, right? So not all of it is just due to my own behavior. Some of it is cultural and genetic and all of this stuff. So stuff, some of the things like, deep, obsessive concern about our weight or appearance, it's not something that we just made up from our own experience, right? That's a lot of cultural stuff that then, but then, our own response to it, our own behavior has gotten mixed into it. So some things are more deeply rooted in our karma. And we don't want these negative aspects to cause suffering for self or others, or else they seem to impede our practice. My addiction to productive thinking means, spaciousness in zazen has been very elusive. So we seek to control them while hoping that in the long run, we can get rid of them. So what ways do we try to use? Primarily like force of will, right? We're just going to be, we're just not going to do that anymore. We're going to be different. We're just going to do that. And, and sometimes we manage to make some difference that way. We ruminate on the reasons for our flaws. We can wish for things to be different. We nurture shame. We dwell on self-recrimination. We just strive repeatedly to be different. We make vows we can't keep. That was a big one for me early in practice when I was just like, ooh, vows, this is great. I'm gonna vow to. And then, it doesn't work that way. You can't just like, well, tomorrow I'm just going to be a different person. seeking out the advice and company of people who seem to have mastered whatever, we're hoping to master or without this flaw, or perhaps angry or judgmental resignation. So all of these approaches have limited effectiveness, and I'm arguing today are a kind of inner violence. And this ranges from very subtle rejection to very flagrant and literal, maybe even physical harm that we do ourselves, but certainly psychological. So just think of trying to help a child to change. And put your approaches in that context. If your inner child is willful, they will rebel, preventing change and encouraging the development of a weird internal passive-aggressive struggle. I have a very strong, it's a curse and a blessing, right? A very strong inner child, or whatever we want to call it. So I would just, all right, I'm going to get up really early and I'm going to meditate and I'm going to do all this stuff before I have to start work. And so I set that alarm at night, and then somebody else wakes up in the morning and they say, screw that. I did that night after night after months and months and years, as if something was going to change. So yeah, that internal passive aggressive struggle, or maybe it will be an aggressive inner struggle and your inner child will seize the controls at times and just drive you into crazy or unhealthy behavior. Just like, all right, I've got the wheel now, so we're getting drunk or whatever, right? Like that happens. Or your inner child may be scared or anxious and obey without understanding why, or out of a fear or desire to be acceptable, operating with a fear of failure and subtle resentment. In any case, your relationship with yourself, just as if you were a parent to a child, is compromised. And usually with little to show for it. So even though we're motivated by a sincere desire to do good, to improve the situation, to be a better person, to do less harm, to, you know, live with greater freedom and wisdom and all of this stuff. I mean, our heart's in the right place, ultimately. So we're motivated by that to relieve suffering. But when we take these approaches that have this inner violence to them, I mean, we know. I mean, even a child would know and be able to pick up on our judgment, our frustration, our impatience, our rejection, our shame, our revulsion. And certainly when we're working with ourselves, you know, we know. So what are the alternatives? How do we keep the precept, do not dwell on past mistakes, create wisdom from ignorance when it comes to working on ourselves and our karma? How do we create real change? I mean, practice is about change. So how do we do that without breaking the first precept, do not kill? So much more transformative is to clearly see and accept whatever manifests within us, making a vow of complete, unconditional inner nonviolence. And we tend to think that this means resignation, giving up, like giving up hope of change and growth and freedom, because like, I can't change it. So I'll just accept it, realize life's just gonna be like this. We may think that this means our less than helpful aspects will just persist and even run wild, right? You can just picture whether you have done this in your own parenting, or you were parented this way, or you've just witnessed it. You know, parents who are just like, I just gotta come down on them, because otherwise they'll just, you know, they'll just run crazy. I gotta just let them know that this is not right. But when we are able to fully accept, embrace, and integrate all aspects of ourselves, it doesn't happen that then these aspects control us, or, you know, we have to resign ourselves to life as it is. So we fully accept, embrace, and integrate all these aspects. We can see everything more clearly. If any change can happen, it will happen out of love. Just like when a parent unconditionally loves their child and steadfastly holds a vision of their child being able to behave in a way that manifests their freedom and leads to positive outcomes. I know you can do it. We know violence is never a sustainable answer, whether inside or outside. So if the child is able to change, it is a fulfillment then of the parent's patient, if firm, faith in them, not an escape from judgment or rejection. Inner integrity is preserved. So how does this happen? To study Buddhism is to study the self. So we learn about these aspects of self we secretly desire, or maybe not secretly, but we secretly desire to expunge, just have done it. Just like, let's just, you know, we could just turn the switch off. If we knew our self-integrity would be more or less the same, we'd just take that little piece and chuck it. So we watch the ways we habitually deal with those aspects, the thoughts and feelings we have about them, the reactions, negative reactions we have to them, the negative consequences of engaging in this inner violence. Does it help? What happens? happens. Does any change happen? Interesting. Let's watch that. And after a while, when we get to know ourselves a little better, we first learn to just stop the inner violence, right? Just cool it. And we don't really know what's going to happen next. Who knows? But we just know, okay, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to berate myself. I'm not going to, you know, wallow in shame. I'm not going to get angry. Just try to cool it, and then we'll see. And then there's a kind of a letting go here too, where it's like, I don't know what's going to happen. I want to control what happens, but I don't know. So we just stop because we've made a vow consistent with the precepts, with our deeper aspirations. So complete acceptance means giving up our agenda to expunge or even change this negative aspect of ourselves at all. We need to recognize whatever it is as part of ourselves. And this may seem strange with all the emphasis on the emptiness of self and giving up self-attachment and all of that. But reality with a capital R has two aspects. Like sides of a coin, like not inseparable, like form and emptiness. It says form is emptiness, emptiness is form. It is this very being, this very body and mind. It is this very being which is empty of inherent, enduring, autonomous self nature. Emptiness, boundarylessness is meaningless without something to be empty and boundaryless. So we don't have the capacity generally to awaken to and open to emptiness or boundarylessness or these challenging aspects of our experience until we fully accept and integrate this body and mind. Or actually, it's better that we don't awaken to emptiness and all of that until this being is fairly integrated and healthy and at peace. Because we transcend this self, we don't destroy it. So I don't know if this is going to help or not, but I figured I would share my recent story regarding this kind of thing. So I talked about my attachment or subtle addiction to productive thinking. So, you know, to this day, I have in the fall, I will have been diligently sitting and practicing Zen for 30 years. And when I sit, my sitting is frequently full of, you know, productive thinking in the sense that it's all about like fixing, improving, creating, organizing. It's the Zen Center. It's the podcast. It's my yard. It's the, you know, political and climate activism I'm into. It's like, we could do this. We could do this. And you know what we need to do there? We need to... Da, da, da. It's just going all the time. And I certainly early on in practice, like struggled with this because to my mind, this was failure. This was not Zazen. This was not mindfulness. This was not what was supposed to be happening. I should not be this attached. I should let go of these thoughts. I should have stillness. Clearly, this is just attachment. So I would sit and try really hard to concentrate on something, to concentrate on the breath, whatever. And it just took superhuman effort. And only in the very middle of session, like sitting 8 hours a day, you know, like the third or fourth day, there'd be a little bit of silence. be like, this is cool. See, this is what's supposed to be happening. The rest of the time, it's like, it doesn't happen. And like, and I just, I mean, it was really on a lot of spiritual ambition. This was really devastating. This was really frustrating. And I really felt like, you know, I don't know, I want to, you know, tread this Dharma path and for my teacher to acknowledge that I understand and maybe someday, you know, receive Dharma transmission or something. That seemed far off, but like, I just wanted to get it, right? I wanted to get it, to know that I got it. And I'm just like, that ain't gonna happen. That just, I cannot see it happening. This ain't gonna happen because I've got what I got going on up here. Now, my teachers were wiser than I was. And when I would confess this terrible, terrible Buddhist sin to them, you know, they would just be like, yeah, you know, and I'd be like, no, you don't understand. You don't understand. But I mean, eventually, and this is why I'm such a, like a convert to, you know, what I call letting go practice as opposed to directed effort practice, because the practice is meant essentially to just be less bothered by it all. Who cares? Who is it who cares? I mean, that's a good question. To just be less bothered by it all. And the more that I just let go and accept, the less, I mean, I don't know, like the thoughts are still there, but they're less compelling. They're less upsetting. They're less, I don't know. As soon as I notice that I'm, you know, drawn up in that, it's not a problem. But even so, there's always more subtle levels that we can go with this intimacy and acceptance. So lately I've been kind of asking myself, as I'm aware that in my life I'm bustling around doing all this stuff, kind of like, what's my motivation? You know, what am I trying to achieve? What am I trying to get? What am I trying to, and it was very interesting, this insight that like a lot of my effort is aimed at making less effort in the future. Like, so that I could organize shit so that I don't have to like do my whole beautiful yard, which you'd be so amazed has been transformed from sheer grass into this lush native wildlife habitat in 8 years, is all so they don't have to mow the lawn. I mean, that's a lot of work in order to not be able to not have to mow the lawn. And, you know, we write up all kinds of documentation here at BrightWay about how you do everything so that we don't have to tell anybody how to do it in the future. You know, it's like, I don't know. So I was like, that is strange. So like, that should make me think twice about like adopting a new project, which if most of my activity is to avoid future stress, why am I, you know, picking up new projects? But then I noticed even underneath that stuff was like just a appetite to create, to improve, just kind of inexplicable. It doesn't have a real like end date in mind. It just likes that. And yet, as I said, like that's all well and good and it can sound lovely and like, you know, so you can say, oh, well, that helped you make a Zen center and, you know, start a podcast and do all this stuff. And that's great. But there is still that aspect of like, you know, after 50 years, aspects of it get kind of ugly. It become, you know, then certain aspects of it become just a compulsion and you're just like, nah. So I still wanted to look deeper. And then in this last session, so in session, I do have these little lovely periods where I let go of the productive thinking, feel some clarity. And I had this sense that my drive and energy for doing all this stuff and improving stuff lived in my body. And I envisioned it kind of like a squirrel running around finding nuts and then finding a place to bury the nuts and then scurrying off to find more nuts. And it was just like this physical drive to do this. And then realizing how often when I'm moving around, it's really like this kind of this physical squirrel nature is in charge, you know? It's just like, I gotta do this stuff. And no degree of spiritual insight, no like, oh, I see it. Everything is perfect just as it is. No degree of spiritual insight convinces this squirrel nature that its activities aren't important. It's like, I that's what I thought. I hoped like, oh, we got all this insight and now we're just going to chill a little bit, but that doesn't happen. So, you know, and I recognize most of us, I don't know if it's just our culture or whatever, but we generally have quite a division between body and mind. And you either kind of over-identify with your body and you really distrust all those smiles, those thoughts and emotions. You never know about them. Or you distrust the body, right? And it's just like, I live up here and I've got this little machine that I drive around and you can't trust it because it's, you know, can get injured. It cannot do physically the things you want it to do. So we usually over-identified with one or the other. Distrust. So I just felt this new level of acceptance of like, I am also my body. This body and this squirrel nature that comes out through it is every bit a part of me as my deepest bodhicitta, whatever. No point in shame or comparison, no point in judgment or rejection, no point in like, oh, woe is me, why did I end up with this? Integrated and accepted. Okay, inner squirrel, you know, how goes it? What are you up today? And as I bustle about, I feel less divided. Because part of me is not like judging and resisting this. We're like, oh, we shouldn't be doing that. So the squirrel's just, I don't know. It's like, I'm going to just kind of look away and pretend we're not bustling around like this, right? But feeling this more of like this profound acceptance, I can just see the inner squirrel is going about her business. Wow, how much energy and determination she has. But being a little less divided, I can also be more mindful about how I am moving. It's unlocking some points of tension and pain in my body that I realized, like, I got this sense of that, like, mentally been driving my body around without asking its permission. You know, it's just like, let's do this thing. Instead of like, okay, body, you know, how about we do this thing? Think you can do this thing? And then there's like some wisdom in the body about how to do it with this, you know, less of a drive. So I can be more mindful of how I'm moving and maybe whether it's time to take a break, look up from the task and see what's really important. But most wonderful of all, perhaps, is just a growth in that sense of self-acceptance, of that inner peace. Because whatever part of ourselves we reject is ourselves. It feels wonderful to be embraced instead of rejected. So this is what I believe in the Precious Mirror Samadhi, it is saying, you are not it, but in truth, it is you. So an inherently existing you is not to be found in these negative aspects. An inherently existing you is not defiled by or burdened by these negative aspects. So in a sense, that is like you are not it, like you are not defined by, or can't look within that and like, oh, that's where, you know, I really am like that. So it's, you are not it, but in truth, it is you. Like, where else would we be? What other being would we be? So in closing, I just want to say, like, you know, if you ask, well, in Buddhism, where are these messages about the inner nonviolence and all this stuff? And it's like, and self-acceptance. And you can't find it like literally there. I think what is happening is Buddhism is meeting modern psychology. And it's not that we are defiling Buddhism or something like that. I mean, we could just, you know, throw it out and, you know, do what we like. But I like to think that slowly but surely Buddhism is being informed by modern psychology, by this sense of, you know, it's complicated in there. and people respond differently. So maybe it is going to make Buddhism more accessible to more people, right? That the means that Buddhism has used over the years of just like, it's pretty straightforward, just sit there on the cushion and don't do that. Well, that might work for some people, and the rest of us, I mean, it might be just like, great, now we've just, you know, encouraged our negative internal karmic patterns. So I think, you know, Buddhism is being informed that way, but it is consistent with Buddhism. And just, here's just a few things within Buddhism that I feel send this message. And the first one is non-harming. So, you know, there's our precept that I was talking about, do not kill. But, you know, fully ordained monastics from the time of the Buddha, they don't even dig in dirt because they might kill a worm or a bug. I mean, that is the extreme to which like non-harming is important. Now, most of us can't live that way, right? We're going to, in order to live, we have to do some killing, and we accept that and try to examine it. But it's still pointing us toward like, really, ideally, we would harm nothing. So if we wouldn't harm a worm, why would we harm ourselves, right? And then there is one of my favorite Lotus Sutra stories about Buddha nature, the lost son who, you know, wanders away from home and forgets himself, runs on hard times. And when he comes back to his father's home and his father has become rich, his father wants him to like accept his inheritance, which is our Buddha nature. But the son can't accept it. He can't see himself that way. And he's just scared that the father's going to throw him in jail or something like that. So the father has him work at menial tasks and just cultivates a relationship over the years until finally the son is able to accept his inheritance. So I think, you know, that is like a 2,000-year-old book talking about low self-esteem. So I don't think this is just a modern thing. And then finally, radical non-duality. So I'm just going to, I'll leave you with a little reading from Zen Master Rinzai. He says, followers of the way, the really first-rate person knows right now that from the first, there has never been anything that needed doing. It's because you don't have enough faith that you rush around moment by moment looking for something. You throw away your head and then hunt for a head, and you can't seem to stop yourselves. You're like the bodhisattva of perfect and immediate enlightenment who manifests his body in the Dharma realm, but who in the midst of the pure land still hates the state of common mortal and prays to become a sage. People like that have yet to forget about making choices. Their minds are still occupied with thoughts of purity or impurity. But the Chan school doesn't see things that way. What counts is this present moment. There's nothing that requires a lot of time. Everything I'm saying to you is for the moment only, medicine to cure the disease. Ultimately, it has no true reality. If you can see things in this way, you will be true people who have left the household, free to spend 10,000 in gold each day. Come on up.
Great talk. Just adding a parallel to your thinking about getting things done, Zazen. I had, and still sometimes have, Zazen that is actually thinking about Zen teaching, Zazen that is thinking about Dharma. Zazen that is taking it apart and putting it back together. And at one point I realized that the reason that I was obsessed in this way was that I was hoping to get to some foundational truth that I could hold in my mind, and that anything that I based upon that would be, by its very nature, unimpeachably correct. Mm. And much could be said about what has gone through my life in order to teach me that only perfection was safe. But I realized that this was actually a really kind of like a gross and unhealthy relationship to have with the teachings. Mm. And then I turned against it pretty aggressively as a thing that needed to be expunged. And then eventually I realized, you know, this need to get to the bottom of things, its negativity is as empty and non-existent as anything else. Mm. I turn out to have gotten a perfectly good career out of this mentality. And as it occasionally happens, I'm like, oh, I know exactly the koan for this situation, or there's a comment, and or oh, there's a cool old Zen story about this, or oh, this is what this thing means, and sometimes that's useful. And so it's this: I must adopt this inner nonviolence, because otherwise, I'm not recognizing the emptiness of negativity. Mm-hmm. Which is not to say that I'm good at it, but just a thought.
Thank you. Yeah, and I think, I mean, if we could just, expunge these parts, I don't think we'd like the result, right? Like, we wouldn't be who we are. It was kind of a weird example maybe, but like, it is very, very, very difficult for women to accept their bodies in this culture. And I mean, from the age before you can even speak, you're being read stories where when the princess comes in, you find out what she looks like. And when the witch comes in, you find out what she looks like. And there's like, you know, so what you, well, how you appear is it. This is the central to your worthiness and whether anyone is going to pay any attention to you at all. And we all want like some attention. We want friends and, you know, influence and whatever. So, you know, I learned very early on that I was very short. And I was not pretty. I was glad not to be really ugly, you know, but I was, you know, I wasn't going to be just like walking down the street, turning any heads. And I resented that. And I, you know, there's been many times in my life where I've looked down at my body and hated it. And really just like, that part needs to go, that part needs to go, that part needs to be different. And yet, you know, I had to be about like, I think it was about 45, but definitely, you know, 50. I'm kind of like, nobody expects me to be pretty anymore. This is great. Like, it's kind of liberating in a way. It's just like, meh. So anyway, I mean, I've let go of a lot of that, but it also formed who I was. Because when I was, I don't know, you know, 11, 12, 13, you're starting to become who you are. I knew I could not rely on that. I could not rely on my appearance to get me anything. So I had to cultivate other things. I had to cultivate intelligence or wit or whatever. I mean, I don't think I wouldn't be the same person if I wasn't in this body. And I don't think I want to go back. So there you go. Judith and then Jessica. And hold the little clip and then it won't make too much noise.
Well, now I've forgotten what I was going to say. But sitting here listening to you, your features are very symmetrical and they are pleasing. But I think your inner squirrel is related to Napoleon Bonaparte's inner squirrel. And I'm pretty sure he had one. And the good part of that is that he put his squirrel to unhealthy means, and you're much more skillful.
Oh, so. All right, Jessica.
So many, many years ago, I was in a seminar with a Jungian author and teacher who I just love. And I asked him, I got my bravery up and I asked him, so there's this inner horror that goes on in my head and it just won't stop. And I worked so hard. When is it going to stop if I keep doing the work? And he just looked at me very kindly and said, it's not. It's not. Your task is to become ever more self-aware so that it's not controlling your story. Mm-hmm. So that was quite a moment for me and began, you know, long, long process of developing more compassion for the karmic circumstances that gave rise to how these aggregates operate. And I will have to say, you know, that the Zen and the Buddhist teachings about, especially your teachings about how karma works in this life and, you know, really thinking about the aggregates has really helped. I'm not that, but in truth, it is me. So anyway, that's what I wanted to share.
Thank you. Denny. Denny Coral, Denny. Oh, Denny, you're still muted.
Thank you. This is so huge for me, and I'm going to try to make it short, but Domio, everything that you described about yourself and your busyness and your creativity, and I mean, I can totally, so totally relate to that. And the thing that, and I will say that when I was 50, I did realize that a large part of the reason for my doing that was to protect myself from what might happen if I just stopped and was silent. And then, and mainly because I've had this, and some of you know, I had this real difficult growing up period, and I was still struggling with it. But right about the time that I was 50, I got cancer, and I couldn't rush around, and I developed this new like compassion for myself because I had to stop. And I also just got this whole new relationship with my body. And I'm not talking about how I look, but just my body. And it's so important to me, has been so important to me from now on. And the other day, I think it was Stuart who asked about the relationship in Zazen, or like whether or not the body was important or part of what is going on during Zazen. And I think you said that you really didn't think there was that much importance. And I plan to come and talk to you about that. But I sometimes, when my mind is going too fast, I will drop into my body and I will feel my heartbeat and feel my breath and just feel what it's like to have sensations in my body, and that helps. And then I seem to relax. And I've been a dancer for years and years and years, and I'm also doing Tai Chi now. And when I'm dancing, it's like meditating. It's like almost like being in samadhi, except that I have sensation, but I'm just totally free. I'm not thinking about anything. And and sometimes this doesn't happen very often, but I will usually sit and then do Tai Chi, which makes Tai Chi so amazing because my body's so relaxed. I just feel it all the way out to my fingertips. But there are days when I'm just so rattled that I do Tai Chi instead and then do standing meditation. And it just works so well. And I could talk about this for an hour, so I'll quit and just say that I really connect with the whole underlying point of your talk. And thank you so much.
Yes, and the only we have Coral and then Leah, but I just want to say briefly that if you heard me say the physical wasn't important, that's unfortunate because I did not ever mean to say that. I mean, actually, for quite a number of years, I've been teaching Zazen, saying simply aim at the correct posture with body and mind, and leave or body and bones and flesh, right? And leave everything to that, not mind. Just like, and yet I think what we have to realize, whatever way in we use, that there is no separation. If we think, oh, I'm going to identify with the body, which of course doesn't involve any thinking or any emotions or any karma or whatever like that, that's bullshit. Like you don't have a body without a mind, just as you don't have a mind without a body. So it's kind of like we're looking for the whole being, sitting with the whole being. Okay, Coral and then Leah. Coral, are you still there? You're still muted if you are.
Oh my gosh, I'm sorry. I'm on my phone and I could not figure out how to unmute myself. So I'll try to be quick. And I was trying to form a coherent thought as everybody else was talking, but of course I was just fascinated with what everybody was saying. So I apologize. I'm still kind of working on this connection that I've made from your talk and my experience at session, which was, you know, this thought of who sits, who brought you to session, who is this? And I kept having this reoccurring feeling that when I asked that question, that I am just this sack of flesh and organs and bones. And I felt that so intensely. It was almost a little too intense. Like it was a little nauseating at times just to think of myself as this like a sack of fluids, for lack of a better phrase. I don't know, it was gross. But it was the sack of organs and bones and whatever that is allowing me to meditate. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the opposite is true, right? And, you know, during the meal chant, we were talking about the giver, the receiver, and a gift. And this body is a gift, and my mind is a gift. And I'm starting to see this connection. It's just really beautiful. And I, you know, I started at Brightway when I was 27, and now I'm 32. And the differences in my body are not so subtle. The pains that I'm feeling, why am I in my early 30s and I'm in so much pain? Why can't I sprint anymore? Why, you know, I'm really hard on myself, both in like the physical realms, like you say, accepting my body and making mistakes at work and stuff like that. And it really helped me make this realization about partway through session to just like, who am I doing that for? And why is it beneficial? And why don't I just take care of my body so I can take care of my mind and vice versa, and get this opportunity to meditate for the rest of my life and sit on the cushion longer. Anyway, that's kind of what I've been carving at during your talk. So thank you.
Thank you for sharing.
Thank you for this talk. I know that it's a very timely talk because my reaction to it is,
hold the clip.
Oh, sorry. Thank you. I know that it's a very timely talk for me to hear because I'm resistant and going, oh yeah. I don't think so.
Not that part of myself. No.
So I've only gotten part way toward what you're saying. I think that through a lot of searching and asking why, like if I come up with thoughts, a lot of times I ask, well, first I notice that they're there, which is a space I didn't have before, but I notice that they're there. And then I ask why, just why, and then go down the, you know, the list of why, if it leads to another answer. Anyway, so in the end of all that, I've learned that, you know, how you say you have this inner busy squirrel that's very into the nuts and where they are. And my part of my inner self is like a, I can't really put an animal to it, but it's like a little girl, like a student at a desk, sitting straight upright, trying very hard to do very well, and with like a shiny apple on the desk for the teacher. But this is not a happy little girl. This is a very stressed, like very uptight, you know, little girl sitting there at the desk. You know, those student desks are kind of hard and kind of hurt. So there's that. And then I think, well, okay, that girl is trying very hard. Why? And it's like, because there's a shame, like that I've done something wrong. And so anyway, this is a lot of psychology, and I've just thought about it. So if I have this girl who's ashamed and wants to do really well, that explains why I have a library of self-help books, which some of you may have also gotten down the rabbit hole of self-help books at one time or another. But that to me would be like a very satisfying book to read, because it's like, oh, well, I'm going to do better, and I'm going to read how to do better and imagine myself better. And then this is also very soothing to that little girl who wants to do better, because there's instructions. And this is, I'd like to say they all work, but they don't. So I'm wondering kind of where to go from here, that if there is that shame, that little girl who wants to do better because she's so ashamed of something, God knows what. That's kind of where I am. I don't know how to integrate that. So I just want maybe just share and then say, well, clarity, it would be like you were saying, I think I'm understanding that you just observe that little squirrel and go, hello, squirrel, you are here and you're doing your thing. Good job. I don't know.
I don't know. I think there's probably many aspects to it, you know, that sense of observing and realizing, like, well, whatever it is you've been trying hasn't really been working, you know. And once we get that, we're like really convinced of that, then our mind starts to open to like, maybe I'll do something else. But then also, like, I don't know, it's like a really profound, it sounds kind of strange, but like letting go of hope is one way that I can kind of manifest, of just, I hope to be someone different. I hope to, yeah, I just, part of me just hopes that this life is going to be different than it is. And to let go of that, it requires a little bit of, well, maybe a lot of like humility and maybe even a little facing grief. Mm-hmm. Just like, this is not how I want things. I don't want to be this. I don't want to feel this. I don't want to have this. But this is what it is. And I don't know. So that, you know, might take a while to like move toward that letting go. But I'm hoping that, you know, this kind of talk is kind of like, well, I recommend just moving in that direction and not wasting decades on trying to expunge or fundamentally change these parts of ourselves, which always have two sides, right? And we're always focusing on the negative and the part that we don't want. And yet if we got rid of them, we would also lose half of our gifts. My teacher was actually one who turned this to me first, because I was confessing, like, this is all related. It's kind of related to the squirrel. So we just different animal, right? Like when I get slowed down, because I'm going about my business, and when something gets in my way, there is irritation. A lot of irritation. And you may not have seen it, but I'm kind of good at editing, you know, that odd, and you know, so I don't do it around you guys. But like my niece was once like, I don't know, something happened in the kitchen, and I like, there was still like several eggs left in the carton, and I just went on the floor, and she was kind of like, ooh, I see, I understand. She's like, you're just like my mom. So I was confessing this to her, like, I, you know, after all these years of practice, this is embarrassing that I still have this, like, these flare-ups of these irrational little rages and whatever. And she was like, you know, your energy is like, she said I was like a rhino, you know, like a china shop or something. Like, just, you have that energy, and that is part of who you are and part of your gift. And when that energy runs into an obstacle, it gets upset, you know? So like, so she was able to see it's all part of one thing, you know? And I don't know, with just more perspective like that, we can just be more skillful with ourselves. So I went over a little, it was a great conversation. So we offer the merit of, oh no, wait, abiding in this ephemeral world, like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Karma.
Thank you,
Romeo.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, everybody.